Accession number 27803, Mr. Vic Stone, Reel 6. Now, we were talking about when you were at number 42 OTU from October 43 onwards. I think if we look at some of the flights you made, what sort of training you got once you'd formed your crew? Take us through the sort of shape of your training then.
Well, first of all, the first ones would always be exercises. We'd be given an exercise maybe for 2, 3, 4 hours.
What sort of exercise?
We all set our own job. The navigator would have certain things he got to do. The bomb man would have certain things he got to do. We all had our own particular job. Now, my particular job, I was listening out at the radio. So my job was to sit there with the earphones on and listen. If I got a message, maybe I'd get a message to convey to the pilot. So I'd have to convey this message to the pilot over the intercom. Maybe the navigator would need to get in touch with me because he wanted a bearing on a certain beacon. So he would get in touch with me. It is also varied and so vast that I knew my job, but I didn't know what the navigator was doing. I knew what his job was to do, but I didn't know what he was doing at that time, because we're all in separate compartments. We're all in like our own little pigeonholes doing our own little job. On an exercise, when you came back, I may have to call up. They may say they want you to call up a station, call up such and such a station. So therefore, you have to look in the notes, find out the station, find out the call sign of the station, call up the station, give them who you are and explain for what reason you're calling them. They knew, because it was all part of the exercise. They were at an airfield somewhere where they were all instructors, because they were giving us information which we were asking for. They knew just what to give us, because they used to do this day in, day out, the whole of their lives. They were doing this, the same thing over and over again, but to different airmen on different courses. Other than that, there's nothing else other than that on the radio. There's nothing I had to do in the aircraft at all.
Now, what about one thing that's mentioned in your memoirs is Christmas Eve celebrations seem to be quite lively.
Well, they were very, very, very lively, yeah, very hectic at times.
What do you remember of that?
Quite a few injuries too. Yes, well, they were always in the big hall, a very, very large hall, and it was made ready for parties. You know, tables were put down and the trestles were put down and the drinks were put out, and of course you could go to the naffy, but the drinks were all put out before you as well. There was plenty of food there. There was music for dancing. Everybody used to have a riotous time there. Lots of fellas had their own idea of dancing. There was one or two Australians there, and they used to tell us how the Aborigines used to dance and do their dance flings, and they would jump up and down. One fella cut his head quite badly one day, and jumping up and hitting the ceiling, because the ceilings weren't all that high, and they were beamed as well, you see, because a lot of these were just ordinary wooden huts, and they weren't that terrifically high. They had no need to have height, because they were only single, just for like sleeping quarters, and the mess was a bit larger, obviously, but not terrifically high in comparison to an ordinary room. There was plenty of entertainment on the camp, always plenty of entertainment. You didn't need to go out at night time unless you really wanted to.
You were now given your own aircraft as well, a Whitley Mark V. I don't know whether that differed much from the previous Whitleys you had.
They varied sometimes in many. Maybe they've changed the engines, they've changed the type of engine, and maybe they've changed the turrets.
So not much difference to you? No.
We would never know if they've altered it or not. If it's a Mark IV, we'd only know by comparing it with a Mark III if we saw a Mark III, like as when I was flying Stirlings, you see.
Now, but after Christmas, you seem to have been doing a variety of exercises with your pilot, and then there's an accident. Now, is it on the 30th of December?
Yeah, it's 30th of December. Yeah,
now,
December
I don't know whether you've got 30th, anything to say about the... there's not much in your memories about... well, what happened on the 30th? What was the background to this accident?
Well, it was a normal exercise which we went off to do. I think it was about a three-hour exercise. I can't remember now. But it was an exercise we went off to do. The weather wasn't all that good. It was very, very sort of stormy weather. Rain was very bad rain. And we did our exercise and came back, headed back to base. Tony called up and got permission to join the circuit to land. Was given his position in the circuit, and we joined the circuit to land. We were just in our normal positions. The bomb aimer and the navigator were just sitting at their tables. The rear gunner was in his turret, and I was sitting at my table. And we came in. We could hear the obviously we could hear over the intercom what was being said, and the pilot had asked permission to come in, and he was given permission to come in, and he was given the runway in which to come in on. He made a run in, but apparently he was coming in either too high or too low, according to the air. There was two controllers. There was one in the control flying control, and there was one on the very end of the runway. They used to call him the airfield control pilot. He didn't have much to say or do at all. He was just there. He would give you the green signal to come in, or the red signal if he didn't want you to land. You know, if you're coming in, he'd give you the red signal to say go around again. Or for some reason, we were given the signal to go around again. We make another approach, and then he's told over the intercom that his approach should be, I forget what it was now, but he was told, put your wheels down. You must have your wheels down. Put your undercarriage down. Well, in an endeavour to put the undercarriage down, the undercarriage, as far as he knew, was down but not locked. But you see, you can't see if the undercarriage is down or not. You can only go by the controls. According to controls, the undercarriage was down, but it wasn't locked on. Well, as it's not locked on, it meant that you didn't know whether you could do an ordinary landing, a wheeled landing or not. So he was told then that he radioed and said about the undercarriage not down, and they said, well, this is an emergency. Take in your emergency stations. So then he told us to get into our emergency positions in the aircraft, which we did. We climbed through the fuselage and got in and sat with our backs to the main spar and that. And, of course...
facing the rear.
Yes. But, of course, from here on, we couldn't hear anything on our intercom because our intercoms didn't stretch right into the back. All we knew is what was going on outside. You can hear the sound of the engines, and we could hear the sound of these engines, and then suddenly they slow, they quieten down, and then they suddenly roared again. And when they roared again, of course, the aircraft, as it quietened down, it must have been gliding in, I should think, and then he must have been told, for some reason, to pull up. And he must have pulled up and pulled up too quickly, pulled up, stalled the aircraft, and it just turned over on its back, and it just fell down. And of course, we were all inside, unfortunately, but there was a. I think it was a convoy, just a small convoy of American lorries were going along the road at the time. They came across and they did manage to get us out of the aircraft. Unfortunately, Tony couldn't get out, but he was definitely killed instantly when we went to look two or three days later. No way could he have survived it. But we were kicking the door. The outside were hammering onto it, telling us, kick the door, get out, you know, and we were just our feet were up against the door. We were laying, if you can visualise, as I'm sitting here now, but on the floor, and with our feet against the door, and we were just pounding and kicking at the door, and suddenly the door went, and they just got hold of us and pulled us out one at a time.
So who got out? The pilot cook was dead.
Yes, so... three of us got out the side there. That was Hank.
Hanks, John Hancock.
Yeah, the bomb man, the navigator, and myself got out there. The turret was cut off, and Des was still in the turrets. Miraculously enough, he was still in the turret. Yes.
Was he all right?
And he was okay, yes. Yes, he was okay. Yes. And then, of course, they...
How badly shaken were you, by the way? Sounds a fairly horrific crash.
Yeah, quite badly at the time, but... No real bad injuries. They obviously put us straight in an ambulance. Well, they had to carry us across the fields, or because it was so soaked with mud, you know, and they couldn't get the ambulances across the field, so they took us across and put us in the ambulances and took us to the Air Force Hospital. And I think I was only in there a day. I can't remember a day, or maybe 2 days. I really can't remember. Honestly, can't remember. But I know it was there was. When I came out, I was taken to see a flight lieutenant, Hallswell, I think it was, or something like this. And he was one of the Albemarle pilots, and, you know, condolences for this and condolences for that. And he said, "How do you feel about flying again?" And I said, "Yes, I would." So he arranged for an aircraft, and I went out, and we only went up for about 5 minutes. I think it just took off and circled the airfield and came in again. But
and were you nervous before the flight?
I don't know as if I was nervous or not. A little bit apprehensive, not so much about the flight, but more about the aircraft, because the Albemarle was not a good aircraft, once again, to get exit from. It was very difficult to get exit from the Albemarle, and they'd had a very bad record, the Albemarles. And that's probably why. But no, not about the flight. I think if I had reasons to be nervous about that, I think I wouldn't have gone. I was quite happy to go. I said yes, I will go. Hank the bomb aimer, we did get another pilot after that.
What about the others? Did the others fly or?
Yes. I don't know. We did, as a crew, we were still a crew without a pilot. And then we were given this pilot of Finlay. Yeah? Well, now...
He was just assigned it.
I think for a very, very short time, we did fly on one or two exercises with him. And then...
With your old crew?
Yes, the old crew. But then... The navigator, he didn't want to fly anymore, understandable too, because he'd had this terrible accident before. And then the bomb aimer, for some unknown reason, him and Des did not want to stay with the pilot we were given. I don't know for what reasons, I've got no idea whatsoever now, I just cannot think. But this was... it was some few weeks after. I mean, as far as I can recall, the first one who dropped out was the navigator. And then for a while we had Finlay, the new pilot, because we decided that we would go... Paddy didn't come with us, he was an officer, but we decided we would take up dancing lessons. But
hang on, let's look at the crew you formed then. So there's Nick Finlay, you call him Paddy, he's a flying officer, an officer. Yeah. What was he like?
Very smart, very dapper little man, very, very efficient. Had the makings from the start, you know, he looked very, very self-assured. Very self-assured, gave you confidence. The man you looked at, you know, and you could think, well, yes, you know.
So you can see no reason why your two didn't want to fly. I mean, you liked
it. Well, yes, I did. Yeah, I could see no reason. No, I could see no reason at all. But mind you, whether, you see, it's not a case of whether we liked Finlay, it's whether Finlay liked us or not as well.
So it may have been the other way around.
So I couldn't really say no. I never ever did know. Why it was, no.
Your navigator was Warrant Officer Nick Butcher.
Yeah.
What was he like? He was experienced, I think.
Very experienced, he was. Very, very experienced. Yes, he'd done 87 ops on Coastal Command. And that is more than the men need do. Yes, and he was very, very, very good indeed, very good. And he proved himself as time went by, you know. I was a rookie and the others were rookies.
Now, there's the bomb aimer was Flying Officer Ron Stanscombe.
Stanscombe, yes.
What was he like?
Yes, very humorous sort of fella, always got a joke on his lips. Always liked to play around, very, very boyish in his ways. Lots of things that you do when you're young lads that he's still done, you know. But very, very good, very good company, very good company. Thoroughly enjoyed his company. Yes.
And the rear gunner was Sergeant Bill Brown?
Bill Brown, yes. Bill Brown, he was a very big fella, he was. I often wonder how he got in there. And he's about 6 foot two, he was. Weighed about 16 stone, I think. How he got in the turret, I really don't know. But no, he's a very quiet fella. Not a great sense of humour in the fact that as air crew, you're always taunting each other about different things, you know. Like when he got in his turret, you know, we used to say, well, you know, you got in the turret, you know. You got in there, if you want to get out, it's up to you. We're not going to help you get out. Just things like this, you know. And he used to get quite upset about it. Don't say things like that. Don't say things like that. You know, when you went on or not, the crew may say, well, wish you luck. You know, and they may come up and they say, your turn for the chop tonight. He said, don't say things like that. Don't talk like that. He was, I don't know how you'd define that, really.
Teasing him.
Yes, but...
How did your relationship grow? You seem to... You started off tough, but you seem to have... decided that dancing lessons would be the way to build up a relationship, you know.
Because you see, we've been to the gunnery school and we've been to have a couple of dances, and at the mess they were having dances, and we thought, well, it'd be nice if we can dance, so we decided we would go to dancing lessons. And this day we went into Derby, found out where there was
the whole crew
a class, and no, Paddy didn't come with us. No, there was just the navigator. The navigator must have left us at this time because he wasn't with us. But our new navigator wasn't with us, I don't think. I think it was just the three of us went. I think there was just
Nick Finley.
Des went, I went, and Hank went, and that's, I think, is what it was. Paddy didn't come with us. No, it's just us three went, as far as I can recall.
So what happened?
Yes.
Then
We used to go. We used to try to do twice a week if we could. We couldn't always manage twice. It may be we were flying or maybe some other duties that we couldn't manage it. We enjoyed it. We were getting on with the easy ones. We were getting on quite well. And at the mess dances, we would get on the floor and have a little dance. And yeah, we thoroughly enjoyed it. But then when it came time to be posted from there, unfortunately. We didn't take up dancing lessons anywhere else. We just let it go. I suppose we thought, well, we know enough to dance. We don't need to go to lessons anymore.
Now, what about the decompression chamber training? Because I've never heard anyone talk about that, and it sounds quite interesting. This is just sort of a specialist...
Decompression chamber. If you can imagine a petrol tanker, you've seen them deliver, can't you? Something like that. Very, very much larger. Very much larger. It's in a room. It could have been an aircraft hangar. It's in this particular room. It's a very, very large, this is. And there are like small control rooms sort of set around about. There may be four different control rooms down the side of this very large room. And there's a decompression chamber, and they tell you what's going to happen to you. They give you an oxygen mask, and you put the oxygen mask on. No. You go into this decompression chamber. They give you an oxygen mask. They give you a pen and a pencil and some paper, and you go in, and you take your seat. And then they tell you that they're going to extract the they're going to start the decompression chamber. In other words, they're going to take all the oxygen out, you see. So you just sit there and you don't know really what's happening. You just sit there thinking everything is fine. And then they may say to you, well, write your name down on a piece of paper. And you write your name down on a piece of paper. And they'll say, now put your oxygen mask on. And you put your oxygen mask on. And all the time they're gracefully taking the oxygen out. So you put your oxygen mask on. And they say, what have you written on your paper? And you look at your paper and you can't make out what you've written on this. It's something what you could swear by you didn't write it, but you did, because you didn't know what you were doing. They'd taken oxygen away, your senses were going, you see. And they give you courses like this. They'd ask you to talk to the chappy next to you, shake his hand and things like this, you know. And of course, it was all very difficult to do. But when you're in there, you don't realise what you're doing. You're told to write, and you write, and you're told to shake hands, and you shake hands. You're told to talk, and you're told to do this and to do that. And I think it's about 20 minutes you're in there altogether. And then they put the oxygen back, and then they leave you for a while in there. And then you come out, and then they go and... They take the pieces of paper and everything away from there, show you what you've done, and you can hear on the voice machine what you've been talking about, what you've been saying. Of course, your voice is all slurred. You don't know it's you at all. Once again, it is a very interesting experience, but it is an extra to the course, I would say.
Now, another thing is you went on a course to Darley Moor. It seems to be a sort of wireless, non-navigational course.
Oh, yes, I had to go to Darley Moor. I don't know really why this was at all. I was sent to Darley Moor 2 or 3 days, I think it was, and I was one stop to... Was it Sloan? No, not Sloan. No.
Doesn't say here. It just says you were in Anson's with Polish pilots. And
I had to go to Darley Moor for some reason, yes. What the reason was, I don't know, because, you see, they'd say, well, look, a Wallisop is needed, so-and-so and so-and-so, you know, and you'd be flown there, and you'd stay there. Or maybe you'd stay there and go somewhere or do something with him, and then you'd be flown back to your own base. Why it was, I don't know. Whether it's all part of this training to see how you fared with a qualified pilot doing a qualified job and assessed again throughout the radio rooms by the exercises you're given, I don't really know. I don't know how long, does it say in there how long I was there?
It doesn't say, just a couple of days, I think.
A couple of days, yes.
It doesn't say
when I was flying back, flew back to Darley Moor? No? No.
Now, so what happens now? You seem to be going into a period of intensive training, because you're going through the 3-month course again, aren't you?
This is it. You see, I had to start the course all over again. Having lost the pilot and a new pilot, you see, so whatever he was doing, I had to go with him, didn't I? See, so it's starting the course again. Put me back quite a bit, really, but however, it had to be. Lots of strange things and events occurred whilst at OTU and also when I was at HCU, which we'll come to shortly.
What kind of thing?
Well, how far have we got there? Have you got past there yet?
Well, you go on ops next, according to this. There's a couple of ops you do while you're at the training.
I think they were just these. They're not... They're what they call nickel raids.
What a nickel raid?
Nickel raid. Well, you carry a whole lot of silver paper. Ever heard of this?
Window.
Well, they're window raids. They call them nickel raids. They're not officially an operation, but it's getting you used to doing an operation. If you didn't come back from that, you got killed as a result of a flying accident, they say. It was never as a result of an operation.
Now, what do you remember about these raids?
Not a lot. Not a lot, actually. Because, you see, the this window was thrown out by mainly the bomb aimer. I don't know whether the rear gunner had some in his turret or not. I didn't have to throw any out, mainly probably because of my job as
and keeping in your notes, there's nothing radio. Much. There's more about the preparations for them than there is about the raids. So you just don't.
When we went on the raid, once I got in the aircraft, I got in my place. I stayed there, you see, and I was there until I got out the aircraft.
Your radio failed.
Yes, something wrong with one of the radios. Yes, we had to return to base.
Now, other things that happened? You said unusual things happened.
Unusual? Did I mention what they were? Or no?
I don't know what they are.
Unusual things happened. Have I got that down there? I can't think of any.
So what happens next then?
Well, I came out the decompression chamber, right? We got on from then, haven't we?
Well, yeah. You're losing me a bit. We've just done the operational flights you did.
Yeah, the nickel raids, yes, yeah. So we came out the compression chamber, onto the nickel raids. We've done a nickel raid.
Recording? Right, so what happened next?
From where? Where are we up to? What, you say? Yeah, right. So as I say, on the nickel raid, I didn't do anything at all.
No, we've done that. So what happened next?
Back on exercises again. Just flying and doing exercises with various pilots, with Paddy and various other pilots in different aircraft. We never had our own aircraft all the time. That's just how the course went on, as far as I can see, as far as I can. Is there something special I put on there?
There is no more in the book after that.
Oh, I see. No. Well, the exercises must just went on. Day exercises, night exercises. Just mainly. See, an OTU, all you're doing is exercises all the time.
So what happened after
this
that?
This is from the OTU, I got stationed to Tilstock.
Now that's to 1665 heavy conversion units.
That's
at Tilstock. And this is where your memoirs end, so you're on your own now.
I'm on my own now. Oh, right.
And that's at Tilstock in Shropshire.
Tilstock in Shropshire, yes.
So what was happening at the this is obviously where you convert to the Stirling. Now what was the conversion process? You went there in, looks like, can't quite, June 44 from the looks of it.
A lot of things happened here. Lots of things happened. I was just, am I recording still? Yes, yeah.
You're always recording. Tell you, you're not.
No, I was just going to say that on my computer in there, I've got pages that follow on. This was to convert from the aircraft we were flying in those days, which were the Whitley, and we're now converting to the Stirling. So it was either Stirling 3 or 4. They had both the Stirlings there. When we went there, obviously this aircraft was new to all of us as a crew. And when we got to HCU, we needed one extra crew member, which would be a flight engineer. We did pick up a flight engineer. How he came to be with us, we don't know, but he was a sergeant Holbert, Gerald Holbert. We called him Jack Holbert.
What was he like?
He became our sixth man. Well, he was a married man, came to our crew. We were all single, and there was always this little feeling about a Jonah in the crew. But however, he was very, very outgoing, very, very gushing, plenty to say for himself, you know, and always up front. If you went somewhere, you know, if you went in for a cup of tea anywhere and you sat down in a restaurant for a cup of tea, this waiters would come over and he'd say, "Oh, hello, darling, are you going to serve us a nice cup of tea?" All this. He was very, very, very outgoing, more gushing than what we were. We got on very well with him. We didn't hold that against him at all, the fact that he's married either, but we did get on with him very well. But it was just his way. He had some very irritating little things. You may be speaking to somebody and he would interrupt with something which was quite relevant to what we're talking about, just to get attention. He always wanted attention to himself all the time. However, he was our sixth member of our crew, and once again, it was getting used to the aircraft.
Now, what did you think of the Stirling Mark 3 and 4?
The Stirling is a fantastic aircraft, absolutely fantastic. We all described it in exactly the same way. It was very, very roomy, plenty of room inside. It was large, it was very large, headroom, plenty of room for me. I had a very nice compact desk. Radios were set out very nice in front of me and below me and on the floor, all very convenient. My chair itself was like something like a swivel chair, armour plating at the back end. They had armour plating at the back end of the chairs, which the others never had, the ordinary aircraft never had. It was very, very good indeed. When we did get our aircraft, we took it up on a test flight, and Paddy said, "Well, we'll see if it does what it's supposed to do in the turn and everything else," and it did. You could just describe it as fantastic. It was, anyway, in every way. Paddy absolutely loved it. We all did. We all loved it. Yes, and it was the only. There's only one fighter aircraft of all that were flying during the war that could outmanoeuvre a Stirling. And that was the Hurricane. That was the only one that could outmaneuver it, which was a great thing for an aircraft of that size and that weight.